Hey there, web or podcast listeners. I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited to make it a little bit shorter and a little bit sweeter. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Well, lawmakers are back at the State House today, hoping to adjourn the 2019 session later today, but that timetable for adjournment is very much up in the air. That's because in these final hours, Democratic leaders are still trying to work out a compromise on two key bills, raising the state minimum wage and paid family leave. And if they do reach an agreement, House Republican leaders are threatening to block efforts to bring these bills to the House floor in an accelerated timetable. So in the lexicon of the legislature, the House GOP are refusing to suspend rules to bring the bills up for immediate consideration. And if they hold on to that position, the session could run into several days next week. And just to add something to all of this, if these bills pass, they face an uncertain future because Governor Phil Scott has signaled his opposition to both bills, and it's unlikely that the Democrats have the votes needed to override the governor's veto in both the House and the Senate. So there is an enormous amount of uncertainty at the State House as we broadcast today during the noon hour. And where is all this heading? Well, today on the program, we're going to look at the latest news from the State House and try to sort all this information out with three great State House reporters. With us, VPR's Pete Hirschfeld, Colin Mine of VT Digger, and Kevin McCollum of 7 Days. Great to have you all here. I know there's a lot happening at the State House, so I really appreciate you sharing this hour with us. So, Pete, the day started with the consideration, perhaps, that the House Republican leadership might not suspend the rules and bring a compromise on the paid family leave and the minimum wage up for a vote. But that's almost getting ahead of ourselves. Are we seeing some difficulty among the House and Senate Democratic leaders even reaching an agreement?
We're seeing some considerable difficulty. And it really came to a head earlier this morning when House Speaker Mitzi Johnson wrote a letter to Senate President Tim Ash, dated today at 10:25 a.m., wherein she said, "We are at an impasse over these two critical bills. We feel like you have not necessarily bargained in good faith." She didn't use those terms, but her letter made clear that she felt like the Senate had not been willing to give in the same way that the House had. She laid out five last best offers for different permutations of what a paid leave minimum wage compromise would look like that the House could agree to. And she told Tim Ash that he had until noon to decide whether or not he was going to accept any of those offers. We all here made a mad dash for Tim Ash after they got off the Senate floor about 45 minutes ago. He would not talk to us, said that he had not read the letter. And we don't know at this point what Tim Ash is going to say in response.
So, Colin, what's the problem here? Why has it been so hard for House Democrats and House Democrats and Senate Democrats to come to some sort of agreement on these two issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think a huge part of it has to do with, where the leadership's at. Tim Ash is, a sort of Bernie Sanders acolyte and has been very clear that $15 minimum wage is his number one priority. Speaker Johnson certainly does not share that priority, and he has said that paid family leave, a robust paid family leave package that allows people to take personal time off, is something that she will absolutely insist upon. And in these five sort of permutations that Peter talked about, it is very clear that the Senate basically is saying we'll take this five-year plan to get to $15 and we'll do 2 years on the same sort of rate of increase. So it would get to the same place, but you don't have that 3 years to get to $15. The House, they've agreed to basically drop the personal injury and illness from their paid family leave bill, but to have it be voluntary, so you could pay a payroll tax if you wanted that insurance, but you wouldn't have to do it. And then in 3 years, it would become mandatory. So that's, I think that's the furthest they're willing to go at this point. And as Peter said, Speaker Johnson said, either you come up with an agreement by noon or, let's go home. But she doesn't have a whole lot of leverage here. There's nothing that she can really do to force the hand. The Senate still has the budget, which is a must-pass bill. If the Senate wants to keep this going, it's certainly their prerogative.
You know, Kevin, if we were sitting here on the first week of the session and we were discussing paid family leave and also legislation to raise the state minimum wage, we probably would have thought that major disagreement would have come between the Democrats and Republican Governor Phil Scott. I'm not sure in our wildest imaginations that we would have seen this scenario playing out. Is this just a matter of these two leaders viewing these two issues differently?
Well, the thing that I think everyone needs to remember about why these two issues are inextricably linked is that there is a sense that if you're going to institute a program of paid family leave that workers need to fund out of their own paychecks, then it makes complete sense to offer an increase in the minimum wage to partially compensate them for that reduction in their payroll taxes. So it's an equity issue, I think, for these two issues to be linked as closely as they are. It's just that, as you say, there are different priorities. One leader values one more than and the other leader values the other, and there is just a standoff underway. And I think we're about to see very soon who's going to blink first in that standoff.
Interestingly, you know, you mentioned sort of the dynamics between the Democrats leading the legislature and Phil Scott. And, you know, there was a move that a lot of people kind of think was a masterstroke by Phil Scott at the beginning of the session where he said, let's all get along. And he really hasn't weighed in. And, you know, the sort of dynamic of us versus him, the sort of Democrats in the legislature versus Phil Scott really hasn't come to be. And it sort of left them to fight amongst themselves and created this dynamic that we're talking about now, which is, you know, Tim Ash versus Mitzi Johnson, as opposed to, you know, the Democratic legislature versus the Republican governor.
And that Tim Ash, Mitzi Johnson dynamic has been fraught even before this year, right? During the first two terms, first term as Speaker and Senate President, there were some growing pains in terms of their relationship meshing in a way that allowed them to work together in a productive and collegial way. And it feels like this session, we've seen a real deterioration in the quality of that relationship. And it's not just a matter of figuring out, okay, what's the correct solution to this policy dilemma we face? It's how can we get a group of senators and House members in the same room that are actually going to be able to have a productive and useful conversation? You know, I think both sides have readily admitted that personalities and approaches have not been meshing particularly well this year. And I think that's one of the things that's preventing them from arriving at a compromise as much as the substance of their dispute over the specifics of policy.
Yeah, I mean, Tim Ash and Mitzi Johnson haven't appeared together for a press conference in who knows how long, you know, and I've heard historically that, you know, when Democrats are leading both chambers, they sort of, you know, run the show together to a certain extent. And yeah, apparently they're not even negotiating. You know, it would seem that majority leaders Becca Ballant in the Senate and Jill Krawinski in the House are really the ones in a dialogue right now, and that it hasn't really been the two leaders talking much.
And Kevin, we were talking about what the Republicans can do. It's a little arcane and inside baseball. It's called suspending the rules in order to bring something up for immediate consideration. But they're definitely making that threat at this time.
Right. No, I interviewed Patty McCoy last night on this issue, and I was looking for any signs that she was bluffing or just sort of hinting that maybe she would do this or under what circumstances, but she said, I will absolutely not suspend the rules in this circumstance. We do not like these bills. We do not want these bills, and that she was unequivocal about that. So it is one of the few powers that a minority party in the state house has at this juncture. And it's a powerful one, right? Because if you force the legislature to come back for another day or another series of days to consider legislation, it's tens of thousands of dollars in taxpayer money to fund the operations of the state house and the salaries of all the legislators. So it is a significant cudgel that she has at this juncture. And I think she's definitely planning to use it. So that threat would essentially be, since we have a rally tomorrow in Montpelier that I don't think anyone thinks the legislature would come back tomorrow, that would push things into Tuesday of next week. And I think there's a lot of people that really at this juncture would like to go home for the Memorial Day weekend and not come back. So I think there's significant influence she has over this process at the moment.
Though it could make for like the ultimate spectacle of all time at the Vermont legislature if you had House and Senate Democrats unable to come to a deal on increasing the $15 minimum wage with 5,000 Bernie Sanders supporters screaming outside. It'd just make for a nice visual.
And Colin, there's a situation here where the House Republicans can delay consideration of these bills, but they can't block them indefinitely. Eventually, the calendar is going to work in the Democrats' favor. So some people might say, are you just postponing the inevitable?
Yeah, I mean, I think they certainly are. And, you know, they have, Republicans have the governor's office. So, you know, in some ways, you know, it's ultimately going to be up to Phil Scott, a Republican, whether or not any of this stuff passes into law. So, I mean, certainly, you know, the Republicans in the state house have been very marginalized this year. You know, last session, at least they had enough votes to uphold the governor's veto, which was a power that they wielded quite often, or at least when they had the opportunity. But, you know, this year they have 43 seats. You need 38 to suspend rules or not suspend rules. So that's basically the only power they have this year is whether or not to suspend rules or not. So you can certainly see why they'd want to use that leverage. I think it's unclear what, you know, generally you would say we want this in exchange for suspending the rules. And with all the other bills sort of, you know, a bow on them, it's hard to see exactly what they might ask for here in exchange for suspending the rules. But I suspect that we'll see if the Democrats can come to an agreement on what they want here on paid leave and minimum wage.
And Pete, Colin talked earlier about the governor's role this session and how it's quite different than last session. How does that influence the whole debate at the State House?
I think it has focused everybody's tension and anxiety on these two bills, paid leave and minimum wage. Recall last year, lawmakers were fighting over very different things, despite the fact that they also passed paid leave and minimum wage bills. They were having fights about the budget, they were having fights about education funding, and they were having those fights not with each other, but with Republican Governor Phil Scott. What's so fascinating to me this year is the budget turned out to be the most non-controversial thing in the building, notwithstanding the fact that there are some pretty significant new expenditures in there. You've got $7.4 million for child care funding. You've got another $2.5 million increase for REACH-UP. It's the state's welfare program. There's more money for home weatherization. I mean, you're talking about tens of millions of dollars in additional new spending this year over last. And not only are they not fighting with the governor over it, Phil Scott has said, okay, this actually looks like a pretty good plan. You want to spend more than I do, but I can live with that. Revenues are looking good. But, you know, part of me feels like there's always going to be a certain amount of free-floating anxiety up at the State House. It's just a question of what it's going to attach itself to. And this year, most definitely, it has attached itself to these two bills.
One of the interesting dynamics, too, when we discuss Phil Scott's veto power over these two bills is that I think he has signaled very clearly that he will veto any paid family leave program that is mandatory, that forces businesses in the state to implement this program. But he has not said as much about the minimum wage increase. He has intimated that he doesn't like it. He has said that he thinks there should be organic wage growth, but he has not said specifically that he would veto that, and he has absolutely not specifically said that he would veto the latest compromise version of the minimum wage increase, which is $12.50 over 2 years. He was very concerned, I think, about getting all the way to 15 in 4 years, and business groups around the state were lobbying people in this building all day long about what a travesty that would be for small businesses around the state, and I think he obviously cares about that tremendously. We do not know whether he would veto the minimum wage law as it is now, and so now you have a dynamic where you have both of these bills in this locked struggle. Maybe if they do pass both of them in some grand compromise in the next few hours, they both go to Phil Scott's desk and only one of them makes it over the finish line. If paid family leave gets vetoed and minimum wage doesn't, then Mitzi Johnson is sitting there with a loss and Tim Ash is sitting there with a win, and we're back to that dynamic about who's going to prevail in this struggle.
Yeah, you know, though it's been interesting to me to listen to what some Senate lawmakers are saying about this two-year solution where you get to $12.50 or somewhere thereabouts by 2021. They are also saying right after that, and then in 2021, we get to come back and figure out how to get to 15. Phil Scott is hearing that, right? Phil Scott knows that businesses in this state are hearing that. And Phil Scott knows that a lot of that the last thing that a lot of businesses want is that kind of volatility and uncertainty in minimum wage policy in the state. And I think if he has any inkling that if he signs this legislation, only to see lawmakers back in 2 years reinstituting the campaign for 15, that will weigh on his decision pretty heavily as to whether or not he's going to sign this one into law.
Yeah, I think it's a real Hail Mary to think that Phil Scott is going to support this minimum wage bill because, you know, it sounds much smaller, 12.25 in 2 years as opposed to 15 and 5, but it's the exact same timeline, like it's the exact same rate of increase that the original bill would have had. And certainly the idea is simply we'll try to get Phil Scott out of office and then get to $15 by 2024. And I think that there's some sort of, you know, there's an ulterior motive for senators to pretend like Phil Scott might sign the bill, which is to justify why we're here a week after the session was supposed to finish. Because if they're simply passing bills to get to Phil Scott's desk and score political points when he vetoes them, you know, I don't think that that's really a great way of justifying why we're here a week and maybe more after this session was supposed to wrap up.
I'm not really sure that the governor, though, is going to be fond of vetoing a minimum wage bump to $12.25 over 2 years. I mean, that is probably a very popular piece of legislation in the state, especially given the background with other states all over the country bumping to 15. So
in New England, especially.
Exactly. So I think he would really have to pause before vetoing a minimum wage increase over 2 years to a more modest level. I think that would be a gut check for him. He would definitely anger a lot of workers. And what message would he be sending to those workers by doing so?
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today, we're looking at the latest news from the State House concerning action on some controversial bills, including raising the state minimum wage and paid family leave. As we broadcast during this noon hour, House and Senate Democrats are still struggling to find a compromise on this issue. And if they do find one, they face the prospect that House Republicans will block the timely consideration of these issues. So all of this puts a huge question mark on the timing of adjournment. And we've got a group of some of Vermont's best political reporters with us to sort through these issues today. Kevin McCallum of 7 Days, Colin Mine of VT Digger, and VPR's Pete Hirschfeld. We'd love to hear from you today what you make of this whole situation and all this chaos and uncertainty at the State House. You know, Colin, when the session started, there was all this talk about the huge majorities in the Senate for the Democrats and the House. The phrase veto-proof majorities was thrown around. Does it turn out that that is not exactly the way that reality has played out?
Yeah, on the day after the election, you know, the Democratic Party put out a statement saying, you know, we've won our veto-proof majority and Governor Phil Scott will never derail our agenda again, pointing specifically to paid leave and minimum wage. And immediately you heard, you know, former Speaker Shap Smith and current Speaker Mitzi Johnson saying, whoa, 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 like this sort of is not as easy as it looks. You know, we might have 100, 103 votes if you combine Democrats and progressives and left-leaning independents. But by no means does that mean that we're going to be able to sort of, you know, get our agenda through. There's a lot of diverse perspectives. This is a very sort of complicated caucus. The Democratic tent in Vermont is very big, and all those things have proven to be very, very true. And, you know, the idea that they could get together more than 100 votes on any of these things, you know, they did it on abortion this year, which I think was one of their big successes of the session. And they've done it on some other things as well. But it doesn't look like it's, you know, sort of possible on these priority economic bills.
And, you know, the people that were elected in this blue wave that we saw last fall, they're not representing the Democratic Party in Montpelier. They're representing the 4,000 or so people on average in any given district. And, you know, one great sort of example of this for me is Vergennes Representative Matt Byrong. He was a delegate for Bernie Sanders in 2016, is part of this sort of new wave of young, fresh blood in the State House, you know, 40-year-old guy, owns a restaurant. He was somebody who voted against the Senate's $15 minimum wage proposal when it was in his committee in the House. And he said, you know, it's just too aggressive for the people of my district. I'm hearing from them that this is not something that's going to work for them, for businesses. He said he even heard from some employees who had some concerns about it. So You know, it's a fallacy, I think, to conflate these new Democratic numbers with automatic support for policies like paid family leave and $15 minimum wage, and we're seeing that come to bear right now.
Yeah, I mean, people say that all politics is local, right, and that it's never more true than in the Vermont House. And I was speaking with former Speaker Shap Smith the other day, and he was saying that, you know, when you have local business leaders in your community as a representative who really don't like legislation, there's a great risk in going against them because, you know, they're sort of the thought leaders in the community. They're the ones who have contact with the voters and all that kind of thing. So I think one of the reasons you see the House having a really hard time getting people together behind these bills is because you have representatives who are really close to their constituencies and really responsive to their constituencies, which often includes people who are really wary about what a minimum, what $15 minimum wage would do.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Tim, who's calling from Warren.
Yes, I guess I'm against the $15 raise because, one, it sounds like the $15 is going to enable us to pay another tax in order to pay for the leave. Business owners, and I work in the restaurant industry, I mean, if we're paying $15 now, then when it goes up to $15 is a minimum wage, then we're going to have to pay more. And it's very hard for small businesses of all different kinds in this state to pay that. You know, and then we also have towns, like our town wants to put another 1% tax to raise money for the town. You know, so it ends up, you're going to give us $15, but then you're going to take another tax, which is going to be, quote unquote, a benefit if we ever use it. But business owners are having a hard enough time. They're struggling to stay open. And if you look around the state, they're closing on a regular basis, especially in my town. So I'm a little mixed on it. I agree with the $15 that we need to make more money, but it should be up to the businesses if they can afford it, which I guess comes down to greed on either side. But that's my comment. Thank you.
All right, Tim, thank you very much. And Kevin, the argument that Governor Phil Scott makes, especially along the Connecticut River Valley, is the minimum wage in New Hampshire is $7.25 an hour. And he thinks that is just going to have a, if Vermont increases to 15, it's going to have a huge impact over there.
Right. You know, Governor Scott is very sensitive to the idea, I think, of Vermont's competitiveness with other states in the region. And this is one of those areas where he thinks it's just a bad idea to get too far out in front of some of the neighboring states. On the issue of the supermajority, I thought it was interesting that the paid family leave vote in the House wasn't able to get more than, I think, 90-some-odd votes. And I wrote a story a few weeks ago trying to analyze about why that was. And what I found was that there were some conservative Democrats in the House who curiously, most of them seem to be from the southwestern part of the state in the Bennington area, who just couldn't get okay with the idea that businesses ought to be required to have this program. And it was just odd that this little cluster of the state was bucking the leadership's desires to get a paid family leave program up. So that's the kind of caucus that Mitzi Johnson has to deal with. They've got all kinds of ideas about the best way to govern, and the supermajority is really a myth.
And I don't think you'll find anybody that doesn't think that these are disruptive proposals, right? If you're going to pay people significantly more than you pay them right now, it is going to cause some kind of economic disruption. And even the legislature's own economic analysts have said, you're probably looking at a net reduction in GDP growth if you go through with this. It, you know, it's negative 0.3%, but it's something. You're looking at job losses over the next 5 years on the order of 3,000+, which is only 1% of total jobs in the state, so it's not huge. A reduction in hours for some workers probably because there won't be enough payroll money to go around at those businesses. On the other hand, though, you're going to have an additional $280 million projected in wages entering the Vermont economy. And so, you know, while one side feels like this disruption is going to be net negative to the Vermont economy and the people that live here, the other side says, you know, sure, there are going to be a few people that might lose their jobs. There are going to be a few people whose hours get cut. But on the whole, we are going to be able to lift a class of low-wage workers to a place that is really different from where they're at right now. And the tangential benefits of that as they ripple across the economy are going to far outweigh whatever negatives we see associated with this.
Today in the program, we're looking at some of the chaos taking place as we speak over at the State House as the Democrats wrestle finding a compromise on paid family leave and raising the state minimum wage. Your thoughts about this issue, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Johanna, who is calling from Middlebury. Johanna,
hello.
Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi there. What's on your mind today?
Hello.
Hi, Johanna. Are you there? Well, this is our day for some interesting phone interactions, and we hope to get her back on the phone just as soon as we can. I guess we're going to find out in a relatively short period of time, Pete. Does your gut tell you this is it? The Speaker and the Senate President, loggerheads, fight it out? Or is there some room here to make a compromise?
You know, I think there's always room for compromise. I mean, the same representative I was mentioning earlier, Matt Byrong, who was uncomfortable with $15 minimum wage by 2024, was actually one of the people that helped come up with the proposal that would get it to $15 an hour by about 2026 or so. So there's always room for compromise, even among people that have some concerns about a specific policy idea. But at this point, the bridge between the House and the Senate feels like it's pretty aflame, and I'm not sure they're going to be able to put it out in time to make a deal. Who knows, though? Maybe cooler heads will prevail.
Yeah, I mean, the majority leader in the Senate, Becca Ballant, said, you know, they'll stick around as long as they have to until it gets done. And I think it would be disastrous for the Democrats to walk away from this session without, you know, being able to at least send these bills to the governor's desk, even if they're in a form that he's likely to veto.
I was going to say, Kevin, that if the Democrats walk away from this session without paid family leave and without raising the state minimum wage, and the reason they walk away is because they had their own disagreements, something tells me that's not going to play very well.
Well, the first hint that I had that maybe people were bracing for that possibility was when I bumped into Tim Ash outside of the State House on his way home for the day or out somewhere for the day, and he started ticking off all the other accomplishments that they had made during the session. And when you start to hear legislators talking about their accomplishments, the other accomplishments, not the question you've asked, why they haven't done these two things, and they start ticking off the other things, that's when I think you start to see them bracing for the possibility that this is not going to happen, and then trying to tout some of the other things that, you know, Pete mentioned several of them, that there are some accomplishments. They have passed a plastic bag ban, right, that they're very proud of. They have improved weatherization programs. They have given a substantial amount of money to child care subsidies so that low-income folks can have the ability to send their kids to good child care facilities. So there's all kinds of accomplishments that they are pointing to, and I think largely that's to divert attention from the disaster that's in front of them, which is that these two primary priorities are maybe blowing up in their face.
Yeah, I was speaking to a lobbyist who said that, you know, they're sort of getting caught in their own spokes, you know, that there's a lot of things they can claim to on top of what Kevin talked about. They've done a lot of work around, you know, raising the minimum age for smoking and taxing e-cigarette products, medical monitoring for toxic pollution, you know, so a lot of things that they could potentially be pointing for, but, you know, all attention is now on these two things that could end up being, you know, a disaster.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today we're looking at the latest news from the State House concerning action on two controversial bills, raising the state minimum wage and paid family leave. The Democrats are trying to come up with a compromise plan. They're having some difficulty. If they do come up with a plan, House Republicans are threatening to block the legislative process, which would delay consideration of that legislation for several days at least. Helping us sort all of this out, Colin Mine of VT Digger, VPR's Pete Hirschfeld, and Kevin McCallum of 7 Days. And your thoughts about that? 1-800-639-2211. We're going to circle back and talk to Johanna in Middlebury. Hi, Johanna. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks, Bob. So while my lovely Democrats are quibbling about this $15 an hour and when that's going to start and when it all this and what it's going to do to small businesses. I'm working with a group of people who are earning $11 an hour and have, you know, have minimum health care. You know, we can't wait for 2 or 4 years for people to be paid a living wage. I really honor small businesses, but we have got to find a way, better way to support them, not on the backs of people who are struggling to make ends meet. And the second thing I want to say is that whatever we give, you know, that $15 an hour, it's going to go directly right back to small businesses because those of us who earn $15 an hour, we spent it, you know, to heat our homes and buy groceries and do things that happen in Vermont. Secondly, the maternity leave bill. My daughter lives in Istanbul, Turkey. She has 3 months of paid maternity leave. The industrialized countries support families with paid maternity leave. Infants and parents need a minimum of 3 months. It's time to just get this done. I feel very discouraged and disheartened that we're stuck. That's all I want to say.
All right, Johanna, thanks very much for your comment. Let's talk to Dave, who's calling from Wilmington. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to say that I think the paid family leave is a luxury, and the minimum wage increase is a necessity, and it needs to be immediately, not 5 years or 2 years or whatever from now. Because by the time you get to that point, it'll be even more that they need to survive.
Okay, Dave, thanks very much for your phone call. Once again, our phone number here at Vermont Edition, 1-800-639-2211. We're looking at the conflict at the State House during the lunch hour over paid family leave and raising the state minimum wage. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Odie, who's calling from Lebanon, New Hampshire. Hey, Odie, welcome to the program.
Oh, good afternoon, or morning, whatever it is. I forgot what time it is. But anyway, my comment is when you take examples, we're going to say McDonald's, they pay $15 an hour. The price of a hamburger is going to go up. The price of everything is going to go up at McDonald's to make up that difference because the companies are not, you know, they're going to make their 30% or 10% or whatever it is that they want to make. So they're going to up the price. So the person who's making $15 an hour is now, instead of paying, I'm just throwing goofy numbers out, but say a dollar for a hamburger, now they're going to be paying $1.75 for a hamburger. So they're right back in the same boat. You know, they have more money, but it costs them more to do anything. I've got one other example with myself. I'm self-employed, and I try to keep my rates down for people that I know, you know, making a lot of money. But a person that is $25 an hour that I'm charging, I'm going to have to spend $30 because now the cost for me to buy products is going to be more also. So mm-hmm. Those people that are making $12 an hour, they're going to $15, but they're going to be paying me more per hour too. So we're really right back in the same boat.
Okay, Dave, thanks very much for your phone call. And Colin, that was when the minimum wage came up on the Senate floor. I remember Senator Joe Benning from Caledonia County saying, hey, this is more than just raising the minimum wage. It's going to have an impact on everybody above it, because if you're making $15 an hour now and the wage goes up, you're going to expect to go up to $16, $17, $18. So there's an added impact there.
Yeah, and as Peter said earlier, you know, no one's saying that this isn't going to have an impact. I think the question in the debate really is over whether that impact, you know, there's going to be ups and downs and whether there's a net benefit and sort of who you're really talking about. You know, there was a compromise bill that was put together in the House Appropriations Committee a couple weeks ago that would have sort of tied the minimum wage to economic growth. So if the economy was poor, wages would slow down. If the economy was hot, wages would speed up a bit. And the idea idea is that this is a way of sort of protecting businesses, when the economy is down, from having this sort of upward pressure on their spending. There was a lot of pushback from more progressive members of the Democratic caucus saying that, this bill should not be crafted around protecting businesses. It should be crafted around supporting workers. And the Senate is really insisting on that position up until now.
One of the stats that stuck with me most this session, I heard in the House Committee on General Housing and Military Affairs when they were taking up the minimum wage bill, and it was the number of tax filers in this state making less than $27,000 a year, and it's 144,000 people. And we're talking about a state with about, 380,000 filers. Whether you think the minimum wage proposal is a great idea or a horrible idea, I think everybody would agree that that is a situation that the state has to contend with in some way, right? Has to reckon with this high number of people that are making less than $30,000 a year. It's tough for lawmakers to figure out what kind of policy instrument you can use to solve that problem. But I think a lot of them are frustrated that they don't have more of them to use, more ways to insinuate themselves in the economy in ways that are going to improve outcomes for those folks. And they feel like the only way they can really do something is by forcing their employers, those people's employers, to pay them more money.
And I think those kind of statistics make it really hard for people who are sort of against the minimum wage, who say we have low employment, which means we have a competitive market, which means that wages will sort of organically go up, that there's no need for the government to sort of step in and force businesses' hand on this, that this will happen naturally. And when you're talking about, a third of taxpayers making less than $27,000 a year, that becomes a pretty hard defense to make, I think.
And another great stat I heard is median household income in this state has stayed flat, actually fallen slightly between 2007 and 2017, which is another pretty amazing statistic when you think about it.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Wade, who's calling from Lunenburg. Hey, Wade, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What's on your mind,
Wade? My comment. I own a small business here, and my comment is that I don't need government running my business anymore. I can't afford the taxes that you guys are putting, the state house are putting on me as it is. I got a kid that works for me. I pay him a pretty fair wage for what he does. And if he wanted to make more money, he could go to school or he could do something, pursue a career or stay here, and eventually I'll pay him more. But I don't need the government telling me what I can and can't do all the time with my business. People are leaving the state of Vermont because of taxes. People cannot afford these policies anymore. The working class people are the ones that are taking the hit. And those same people that you're trying to throw money at are the same people that are going to be let go when we add $2 more an hour, because guys like me who are barely hanging on to keep my business going are going to have to pay these $6 or $8 or $10 more an hour. I'm going to have to start cutting people.
Okay, Wade, we appreciate your phone call and your perspective very much. Let's see if we can get a quick call in from Cynthia, who's calling from Montpelier. Hi, Cynthia. Welcome to the program.
Hi. This is Cecile.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry about that. Hi. My mistake.
That's okay. I understand maybe there's a little static going on. So actually, I have a whole different perspective from Wade, because I have two grown daughters who have left the state because they can just make more money elsewhere. And that's something I wonder about. And you keep hearing about, like, oh, let's attract younger workers to the state. Well, I don't know how you're going to do that without livable wages and paid family leave. They can get that elsewhere.
Cecilia, thanks very much for your phone call. Kevin, that's the argument that a lot of Democrats are making to the governor, in fact. If you want to attract more young families to the state of Vermont, hey, paid family leave and raising the minimum wage, two good ways to do it.
Well, everybody agrees those things would benefit the state's economy tremendously. This is why the governor has got his program for offering $10,000 to people from other parts of the country to move here. So it's it's definitely something that everyone agrees would be great for the state. But one point I want to get back to that Pete mentioned about the job loss and that Wade mentioned was, so Wade's essentially saying, right, I'm going to have to lay some people off here. These are jobs that are going to be lost. And what the counter to you, that you always hear to that is there's 2% unemployment in the state. If that guy gets laid off from that low-income job, that's unfortunate, and that's a problem. But he or she will almost certainly be able to pick something up in another industry, in another area, if so inclined. So the unemployment rate and historic lows, I believe, at the moment is one of the drivers in this conversation for sure.
There's a lot of uncertainty and chaos at the State House at this lunch hour. We're not entirely sure that the session will end tonight or next week sometime. But one thing we are pretty sure of is that lawmakers won't be back in Montpelier tomorrow. As we discussed earlier, Senator Bernie Sanders is holding a kickoff rally at the State House, excuse me, for his presidential bid. Thousands of people are expected in Montpelier. Pretty clear that lawmakers don't want to get caught up in all that traffic and activity. Many thanks to our panel today. Great to have you here for this hour. I know a very busy time over at the State House. Colin Mine of VT Digger, Kevin McCallum of 7 Days, and VPR's Pete Hirschfeld. Thank you all very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.